True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Vicky was good to her daughter, loved her daughter. Her mother would say, I can't get her to go to church, I can't get her to go to youth group. She didn't want to have anything to do with any of her mom's activities or suggestions. I paged her, and she was very good at returning my phone calls, and all day long, none of us could reach her. I started thinking the worst. I thought something's happened.
As soon as the red flag went up that this was a responsible working adult that just had disappeared, we knew something was wrong. It was not the loving mother-daughter relationship all the time.
Valesa had threatened her that if she tried to split her and Adam up, that they had friends in certain places that would harm her.
They wanted to be together no matter what. She was headstrong in the way that she wanted to lead her life.
I got a phone call from Adam Davis, and he said that they were heading to Arizona.
He said that Valesa was with him?
Yes.
And that she's okay now?
Yes. She's okay.
He said something about her being in on it?
She didn't, you know, say stop, don't hit my mom. I don't know.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
So today's episode is a really interesting one. I think that you'll enjoy talking about it, Dick.
Well, I've been looking at it a little bit. There's some interesting mother-daughter dynamics going on here.
Yeah. So Vicki Robinson, she was a realtor and a single mother of two teenage girls when she went missing in June 1998. It was a typical Friday night in Tampa, Florida. She stayed in, cooking dinner for her boyfriend, Jim Englert. And Vicki had been divorced for about 4 years, and she'd been dating Jim for 2 years. And they were talking about getting married soon.
They were serious.
Yes. Now, Vicki's younger daughter, Valesa, was 15 years old, and she'd been giving Vicki a tough time lately. Rebelling, using drugs. She'd begun having sex with her 19-year-old boyfriend, Adam Davis. And Adam Davis was kind of a nightmare for any mother because he was kind of the rebel, tattooed, pierced, good-looking bad boy.
Just the kind of guy you don't want your daughter dating.
Exactly.
Or even being around.
Right. Especially a 15-year-old.
Yeah. And we've talked about age differences before. This one, 15 versus 19, that's, you say, well, it's only 4 years, but that's a light years away difference.
Well, that's the difference between a child and an adult, legally, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I guess she could have had him arrested for statutory rape.
Maybe. I don't know. That's a whole other issue.
Well,
maybe we can talk about that.
She's 15.
Right. We can talk about that. Now, Vicki was also a devout Christian, and she was frustrated by her inability to keep Valesa on a healthy path. It gotten to the point where the mother and daughter were living totally separate lives, almost like in some ways Vicki had given up, although she hadn't really given up. Now, while Vicki spent the evening with her boyfriend, Valesa spent time with her boyfriend and his friend, John Wispel. They were using drugs, and they ended up going out to the local Denny's. Now, Jim left the house around 11 p.m. to go home, kissing Vicki goodnight, and they made plans to go to the beach together the next day. On Saturday morning, Vicki was gone. Her boyfriend, Jim, and a girlfriend of Vicki's tried to contact her with no success. She didn't answer her phone or her front door, and everyone grew even more concerned when they couldn't find Valesa either. So what had happened after 11 p.m. that Friday to Valesa and Vicki, a single mom and her 15-year-old child, nobody knew. So come and join us at the Quiet End as we talk about the disappearances of Vicki and Valesa Robinson. The truth, when revealed, is really going to make your blood run cold.
It sure is.
So some thanks to 5-star reviewers: Christy G, Nicolie 13, Ashleen KMB, and Beige Girl.
beige girl.
It's unremarkable, but kind of crafty and kind of like it. Beige girl.
Yeah, I would think it kind of blends into the background, you know?
Yeah. Although maybe it's a sarcastic comment on really a flamboyant person.
That could be.
Yeah.
Kind of a double meaning type of thing.
Exactly.
I'll look at it that way.
Okay. What'd you bring for beer?
Well, I know I might seem to be in a rut, but it's another Cigar City Brewing Company beer.
Well, it's because we chose some Florida cases this month without really planning, but...
Yeah, well, and there's certainly way more breweries in Florida than just Cigar City, but I seem to be stuck in that kind of Cigar City rut because it's beers that I love, and I like drinking them, and I like to report about them.
Well, I don't know if it's a rut if you like them. I mean, a rut is inherently bad by definition.
Well, maybe the people listening to me think it's in a rut.
Maybe. But I think if they're good beers, you're safe. You're okay.
They make some world-class beers.
Yeah.
This beer is called Café Americano. And if there wasn't the fact that they also produce Marshall Zukov Stout, this would probably be one of my favorite stouts. So it's a double or imperial stout. And just for everyone's edification, and you've probably heard me say this before, they're inspired by Russian imperial stouts. They tend to be barrel-aged in bourbon or whiskey barrels. They might be infused with coffee or chocolate. And they tend to be higher in alcohol. So they are sipping beers. Now, this particular one pours a pitch black, opaque color. There's a khaki head with a great amount of lacing, that nice foamy stuff that sticks to the glass.
Nice.
It has a coffee, chocolate, and burnt malt aroma. The taste pretty much follows that. Coffee, chocolate, burnt malt. There's a fair amount of char, like charcoal.
Really?
Pleasant charcoal.
How do they do that?
Smoky stuff.
Like what?
Just the way they cook the barley or heat the barley. And you can notice the alcohol in the taste. Fairly strong alcohol taste.
Yeah, well, but you said it's high alcohol percentage. What percent alcohol is it?
Around 12.
Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah. Big-bodied beer.
Okay, now why is the foamy stick-to-the-glass head better than other heads?
Well, it just is prettier. It's not necessarily better.
Oh, okay.
It just looks nice where you have this spider web lacy appearance to the inside of the glass.
Okay.
So it doesn't confer any better or worse attribute to the beer.
Okay. You just like the look of it.
Visually appealing.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Well, let's open it up.
Okay. Okay, Jill, let's head on down to the quiet end. I've got our beautiful snifters.
Yes.
A second backup beer.
Lovely beer.
And we're ready to go.
Okay, let's do it. As a young child, Valesa Robinson was pretty typical. She was involved in church activities and even athletics. And everyone who knew Valesa wondered how a child so carefree and innocent had turned into the rebellious teen she was when she and her mother disappeared. Had she run off with her 19-year-old boyfriend, Adam? If so, where was her mother, Vicky? Valesa's sister, Michelle, said that her sister's troubles started at age 11 when her parents divorced. My sister took the divorce very hard. She changed a lot when that happened, Michelle said. So after the divorce, Valesa didn't see much of her father, Chuck Robinson. He moved out of state in search of a new sales job. Valesa was devastated about her parents' breakup, and she really missed her father because he was her biggest supporter. Her mother also wasn't around very much, according to Valesa's friend Christy Collins. Vicky Robinson had a new job as a real estate broker, and she also had a pretty busy social life. Now Michelle recalled how Valesa didn't fit in at school and how kids were mean to her. She seemed lonely and lost. At age 12, Valesa had been allowed to join a rock band with some men in their 20s. Now that's when she first started experimenting with drugs, so she's in the 8th grade, and things just were getting worse.
So wait a minute. She was allowed to join a rock band with people in their 20s?
Yes, men in their 20s.
Her mother allowed this?
Sounds like it.
Well, I guess I can see that. I mean, on the surface, I would say,
Yeah.
You're way too young.
Right.
To do this.
I think I would say that below the surface as well.
Well, but then at the same time, I'm trying to think like her mother, who might be saying to herself, you know, the divorce has been really hard on her. Her father's never around. I work a lot of hours. I'm not around that much. Maybe this would be a good thing for her, to have a outlet for her energy and stuff.
I don't think so.
No?
I think I'd make her have someone go with her. Her sister or a parent or someone.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case.
No. There were a few things Vicky did that were kind of a little too permissive or even negligent in some ways.
Yeah, and this is a woman who's a staunch churchgoer.
Yes. Well, I don't know how staunch she was, but she was a faithful churchgoer.
Okay.
She was a Christian.
I'll say faithful.
Okay.
Instead of staunch. But but the church played a very important role in her life.
Yes, yes, it did. And she wanted the girls to go with her, and Valesa had gotten to the point where she was refusing to go by the time she was 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like you need to force them to go. I know it's not always easy, but you really can't let them start making too many choices at that age, can you?
No, you can't.
No, because then they get control.
A lot of times that happens, and exactly what you just said occurs, that the child becomes more in control.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nobody said it's easy to raise teenagers, that's for sure.
Oh, no.
No.
We both know that from experience, don't we?
We do. And I'm sure you've had many in your practice that have been difficult.
Oh, that goes without saying.
I mean, have you had parents call and say, you know, Johnny won't come to his appointment?
I've had that. I've had parents call and say the child refuses to go to school, refuses to go out with them when the parents go out for dinner or something.
Yeah.
You know, just isolating themselves.
Yeah, that's hard. What do you do?
Well, the only thing I feel like I can do is suggest that they go to see a therapist.
Right, but what if the kid won't go to therapy?
Well, my typical approach to that is to try it. If you promise me you'll try it for 2 or 3 visits, then you can decide whether you want to continue or not.
Okay.
And generally, most of the time, the child starts seeing that they are helped by the therapist. They have a rapport with the therapist, and they do pretty well. So my overall failure rate isn't terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But I just got to get them to go in the first place.
Right, which isn't easy.
No, it isn't.
No.
But usually I can get them to commit to a couple times.
Well, that's pretty good. But I just think that letting her go and join a rock band, and I mean, usually rock bands, they practice on weekends and at night.
Right.
And drugs and alcohol can be involved.
Right, particularly with guys in their 20s.
Sure.
So, yeah, I'd be looking at that and thinking, this isn't good.
No, I don't think I'd like that. And like your sister said, that's when she started experimenting with drugs. So she's only in the 8th grade. And in her diary at age 13, Valesa wrote how she lost her virginity and how she'd been using LSD. Then she started skipping school and doing more drugs, and she started staying out all night. So I can see this was difficult for Vicky.
Yeah, we're definitely heading down a descending path.
Yes.
This isn't good.
No, and it doesn't sound like the father was very helpful.
I don't think he had much of any involvement, did he?
Well, he was out of the state looking for a job somewhere else, so.
Yeah, yes, he was, but
yeah.
I don't recall reading or seeing anything that said he tried to intervene or help.
No, no. So she's staying out at night, she's doing drugs, she's having sex, and Vicky's feeling like she's at the end of her rope. And Valesa refused to go to counseling, and it did kind of seem like Vicky had given up, but she was just hoping that her daughter's behavior was a phase and she'd outgrow it.
Well, why didn't she, just to play devil's advocate, kind of the court of last resort is to call the crisis hotline, or whatever they call it down in Florida, and have her kind of involuntarily committed.
Yeah, I mean, that might be what you'd have to do at that point.
Yeah, she's refusing all intervention.
Right, it's true. Well, I don't know exactly what Vicky could have done differently.
Yeah, it's a tough situation.
Yeah. Jim Angler, Vicky's boyfriend, really observed that Valesa was beyond any kind of discipline they tried to give her.
Yeah, it sounds like Valesa came and went as she pleased and did whatever she wanted.
Yeah, it kind of does sound like that, doesn't it? Like it gotten to that point.
Yep.
Yeah. Then something happened during the summer after Valesa finished the eighth grade that Valesa's father says may have been a turning point. Vicki Robinson and Jim Englert took a two-week family vacation to Michigan. And when Valesa refused to go with them, Vicki left her young daughter behind alone for 2 weeks. That wasn't smart.
That sounds like a solution, doesn't it? Jeez.
No. I wonder if maybe she left her, someone in charge of her or something. I don't know. But that's what the father said.
Yeah. Although, again, he was a pretty absentee father, so who knows?
Who knows, yeah. But that was definitely not a good idea.
Far from it.
No, because if she's already thinking that you don't care about her and she wants to be separated from you and then you abandon her, which she's probably dealing with abandonment from her father already.
Yeah, and then mom disappears for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's...
With her boyfriend.
Yeah, that's not good.
Of course, she could have gone with him.
That's what she wanted her to do.
I know, and Valesa didn't want to, but
right.
Valesa could have gone with him and made their 2 weeks stay miserable.
Well, I know, but at least they would have been with her.
Right.
She would have been away from some bad influences for a while.
Sure.
So, well, Chuck Robinson, the father, he thought it was unconscionable, and he thought it was nuts that they left her for 2 whole weeks. And he also said that Vicki never called to check on Valesa, even though she was only 14.
Now, did the older sister go to Michigan with the family?
I don't know.
Because it sounds like Valesa was left home alone.
Well, I mean, the older sister, is that really... I mean, if the mom can't control her, what's the older sister going to do?
Well, I know, but maybe there's another voice to be heard.
Yeah, I just don't know.
But I think that Valesa was the only one left behind. Everyone else went.
Well, I don't know. I know that Vicki went with her boyfriend.
Yeah. But it was a family vacation, so.
Yeah, right.
So it was going to be Vicki, the boyfriend, and both daughters.
Probably.
And Valesa wouldn't go, so she stayed home.
Right. That's kind of what it sounds like, doesn't it?
Yep.
Well, that wasn't very smart. Now, shortly after that vacation, when Valesa started ninth grade, that's when she met 18-year-old Adam Davis, who became her boyfriend. Now, he was living on the streets. His father had died, and his mother had abandoned him when he was only 2. He was a high school dropout, and he dealt drugs. And by the time Vicki Robinson realized her daughter was out of control, Davis and Valesa had a devotion that was bordering on obsession between the two of them. Now, although she did try, it seemed impossible to keep Adam and Valesa apart. Valesa ran away several times to be with Adam. She'd disappear for a day or two. And Adam had been in and out of jail also for burglaries and car theft. And then Valesa got in trouble for shoplifting. So things have just taken a really bad turn.
That's an understatement, isn't
yeah.
it? So why doesn't mom call the police?
I don't know.
She's still trying to deal with this as a devout Christian, trying to get her daughter to see the right way.
I don't know. I mean, if he's 18 and she's 14 or 15, it seems like she could call the police.
Well, yeah.
But it's, I don't know.
It's tough
to get that really to
do anything. It's
tough
to do that. And it's easy for us to sit here and say, well, this is how I would have done it.
Right.
We didn't live through that hell.
Right.
So I don't know how we would have done it.
Plus, she's gone through a divorce. She's working full time. You know, she does have a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it doesn't sound like Jim was a lot of help either, to be honest with you, from what I've read.
The boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, not his kid.
Well, if they were talking about marriage, he should have been taking that role a bit, don't you think?
Well, yes, I do.
Yes.
But I'm thinking, you know, it's not his. Let Vicki deal with it.
Well, that's not very helpful.
No, so I'd dump him too.
Yeah, I think probably.
I'd be thinking you're not very helpful to me with my daughter and all the difficulties she has.
Well, I mean, that's what we think. Maybe Vicki wanted to handle it herself and told Jim to stay out of it. We don't know.
I guess that's true.
Could be that way. Now, Adam and Valesa, they're in love, and they say that they want to get married and spend the rest of their lives together. You know, typical teenage love stuff.
Of course they do.
Now, although Vicky would ground Valesa and try and keep her away from Adam, Valesa would sneak out to see him. Now, Adam said that he was trying to win over Vicky, but she didn't approve of his relationship with Valesa, which we really can't blame her.
No.
No. It's not an appropriate relationship. It's
totally not.
I mean, and in a way, I kind of, beginning to read about this story, I do have some sympathy for him, right? His mom left when he was a toddler. His father died. It's kind of no wonder he's getting into trouble.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean you want him going out with your daughter.
No, but who's looking out for him, from his family?
Absolutely nobody.
So the whole thing is just sad. So it was not unusual. We're on Friday, June 26, 1998. So Valesa had hung out with Adam and his friend John. And then after Vicky went to bed and Jim had gone home, Valesa snuck out of the house to meet up with John and Adam at the local Denny's. Now, they'd stolen the van, Vicky's van, which I guess they'd done before, taken it out after she goes to bed. Vicky had been quietly making plans to enroll Valesa in Stepping Stones Farms the following week. Now, this is a boarding school for troubled girls, which had been recommended by one of Vicky's clients. So this is a good idea.
Okay, so she's going to do something.
Yeah, and it sounds like a really good idea.
It does to me, on the surface anyway.
Yeah, well, this whole crime happens before she can get that going, right? She's got the application filled out, but it's going to be another week or so. So the next Saturday morning, Jim Englert is worried about Vicky because she misses their date at the beach. So he goes to the house, but no one answers the door, and he doesn't have a key. So he called the Tampa police. So police entered the house, but they found no signs of foul play. Vicky and Valesa were nowhere to be found, though. And Jim noticed that a large trash barrel was missing from the garage. Also, Vicky's minivan was gone. So something's up here.
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
It sure does.
So someone's absconded with the van.
Yes, and both mother and daughter are gone.
Yes, suspicious. Suspicious enough that the police put out a missing persons bulletin on both Vicky and Valesa. Once police were aware that Vicky was a responsible working woman, they became more concerned.
Sure, so she's not a flighty person.
No.
Right? She's not just going to run off.
She wouldn't just run off. The boyfriend, Jim, told police about the troubles between Valesa and Vicky. He told police about Valesa's boyfriend, who Vicky disapproved of, and their habitual drug use. It was revealed that Valesa had become violent with Vicky.
So this was a new thing.
Yeah, we hadn't gotten into that yet.
No.
Recently, Vicky had become afraid of Valesa after she threatened that she knew people would kill her if she tried to break up Adam and Valesa.
Well, that's really something to hear from your daughter.
Yeah, you better not try to break us up because we'll have you killed.
Wow.
Blech.
But would you take it seriously? I don't know. It's creepy. Creepy.
I think I'd take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, he is a criminal, and she's been really acting out badly, so I think I would too.
There's another opportunity. I mean, besides this boarding school that she was going to enroll her in, maybe this would have been a time to call the police.
Yes, I think that might have been a good time.
So within 24 hours into the investigation, police had tracked activity on Vicky's ATM card. So at a Tampa Bank ATM, video surveillance showed John Wispel using the ATM card. In the background, you could see Vicky's minivan. So now the investigation was a possible homicide with Adam Davis and John Wispel as suspects. But police weren't sure if Valesa was a victim of a crime or an accomplice.
Yeah, it would be hard to say, wouldn't it? Because she's acting out. But on the other hand, there's these two guys that are older and troublemakers. Maybe they took advantage of her and her mother. We don't know.
And the videos at the ATM and stuff, there's no sign of Valesa.
Right, it's the guy.
It's just the guy.
Right, true.
The next day, June 29th, Adam Davis and John Wispel were captured on camera at a local store using Vicky's credit card.
So still no Valesa on camera.
No Vicky, no Valesa. Jim Englert made a tearful plea on the evening news for information about the location of Vicky Robinson. Next, we go up to the 1st of July, 4 days after the disappearance, mm-hmm. police received a call from someone who had heard from Adam Davis. This young woman said that Adam Davis had called her and said he was heading to Arizona with Valesa. Adam had confessed to the caller that he and John Wispel had killed Vicky. So at this point, it seemed that Valesa was traveling willfully with the two men.
Wow.
So police began to consider that Valesa was in on the murder of her own mother.
And that is...
As hard as that is to believe.
Right, yeah.
So the use of Vicky's credit and debit cards left a trail of electronic breadcrumbs as Adam, John, and Valesa traveled west. On July 2nd, the trail led to the town of Fort Stockton, Texas, which is about 1,400 miles from Tampa. Local Texas Sheriff Bruce Wilson had been following the investigation. He and his deputy, along with a state trooper, waited for them on the highway. Sure enough, here comes the minivan.
Right, very dramatic.
Heading west on I-10. They tried to pull the van over, but the van wouldn't stop. Finally, they shot out the tires and took the three people into custody.
Yeah, right. So they arrested her. So they thought she was in on it.
They arrested all three of them, right.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to take a moment here, Dick, to talk about our sponsor, because as you know, today's show is brought to you by Audible. Now, Audible has the best audiobook performances. They have an unmatched selection, and they have the most exclusive content. We just recently had a book on Audible that we listened to. Want to talk about it a little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
This most recent one is called Golden Prey by John Sanford. So this is a whole series of books by Sanford. It involves a guy named Lucas Davenport. He used to be a police officer in Minneapolis. He worked for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And his first book has got to be about 30 years old.
Wow.
At least 20 anyway.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a whole series of them. They all have Prey, P-R-E-Y, in the title. And they're just fun reads. So this particular one, our hero Lucas is now a federal U.S. Marshal. And he's involved in a drug cartel killing. And that's all I'll say about that, because I don't want to give the plot away.
So they're all mysteries.
They're all murder mysteries, yes. And they're all, to me, it's like a summer read, because they're fairly quick. They're fun, interesting.
So if you were listening to Golden Prey by John Sanford on Audible, you would experience things like hair raising on the back of your neck or getting goosebumps.
You would.
And you also might get a few chuckles because it has a little comedy element to it.
Oh, yeah. Lucas is a wise ass.
Well, with an Audible mystery performance so powerful, you can feel the suspense anywhere because you can listen to Audible anywhere.
You can.
You can start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. Learn more at audible.com/brewery. That's audible.com/brewery, B-R-E-W-E-R-Y. So, back to our case. Tampa detectives flew to Texas to interview the three teenagers because they'd been caught where?
Fort Stockton.
Okay.
West Texas.
All right, so they'd gotten pretty far.
1,400 miles.
Wow. So Valesa said she hadn't seen her mother since the evening of June 26th, and she denied hurting her. So for about 15 minutes, she stuck to this story, but she didn't last very long. She shocked detectives within 15-20 minutes with a detailed confession of her mother's murder. Now, Valesa said she'd stabbed her mother and slashed her throat. Afterwards, Adam and John had cleaned up the blood. Vicky'd been stuffed into the large trash barrel that was missing from the garage. Now, Valesa's demeanor was very disturbing. She was calm and matter-of-fact, and she didn't give any reason why she killed her mom.
No, she didn't. And she was very flat affect when she discussed the murder.
Right. Now, this is shocking because a girl killing her mom is quite rare, right?
Yes, it is. When I looked up matricide, which is from Latin for mother killing,
mm-hmm.
for those of you who aren't Latin scholars.
Okay.
Like me, I had to look it up. Anyway, there's in the annals of matricide, there's overwhelmingly a preponderance of male perpetrators.
Okay.
Hardly any women kill their mothers.
Hmm.
So just, I picked out a few famous mother killers.
Okay.
Just to list a few.
All right, good.
And you're going to see these ones I picked, there's only a couple that are women. So just Adam Lanza, who is the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooter, killed his mother before he went on the rampage at the school. And
I remember hearing about that.
The other corollary or similar one to that, Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower shooter, who killed a dozen or more people on the University of Texas campus. He killed his mother before he started his shooting spree. Then we have the Menendez twins, killed both their parents.
I forgot about them. That's a very famous one.
And I have other twins, Jasmia and Tasmia Whitehead, killed their mother. Here's a woman, a couple women that killed their mother.
Yes, I remember seeing a program about those two. They were like spoiled brat teenagers who actually plotted and ganged up on their hardworking, quite loving mother and murdered her and then tried to act all upset. And that was a really shocking case.
I have some older ones. The mentally ill sister of the essayist Charles Lamb, who we all probably read in high school or college.
I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
so what is this?
He's a British essayist.
Oh, essayist. Okay.
But his sister killed the mother.
Oh, she was mentally ill, the sister.
She was mentally ill, and apparently she was in a manic phase when she did the killing.
Okay.
And then maybe another famous one, Emperor Nero ordered the murder of his mother because he thought she was conspiring against him.
Oh, well, that's a whole different thing, I think, but
yeah.
Okay.
But those are...
Now, what about Lizzie Borden?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's another one.
That's a famous one.
Mm-hmm.
But she killed both her parents or just her mother?
Just her mother, I think.
Okay. Might have been both.
Could have been. All I remember is Lizzie Borden with an axe gave her mother 40 whacks.
Yeah, but I think then she goes on to do more.
Anyway,
it's rare.
It's pretty rare to be a daughter or a woman killing your mother.
Okay. Well, John Wispel was interviewed, and he seemed really eager to tell his story. Now, according to him, on the 26th of June, Vicki Robinson ran errands with her daughter, Valesa, and Adam and him, so she took them with her.
Yeah, well, that way she could keep an eye on him.
Yeah, I think that's probably a smart idea. Now, after dinner that evening, Adam and John left the Robinson home and went to the Denny's. Later that evening, Valesa Robinson snuck out of her home and joined Adam and John at the restaurant. So the three of them at the restaurant were in search of drugs, so they bought some LSD and they had gone out in the van to get that, and then they came back to the restaurant while they're high on it. And while at the restaurant, Valesa said that the three of them should kill her mother. Now, he said that Valesa was smiling, and he thought she was joking. But Adam and Valesa began to plan out how they would do the murder, agreeing on this lethal heroin overdose plan.
You know, all three of them are high on LSD, right?
Yes.
So I don't know how fruitful a discussion that would have been.
Right.
But, and particularly, I got a great idea. Let's buy some heroin and inject it.
Right, yeah.
How would they even know how much to inject?
I don't know. I don't know if they'd done heroin.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The three went back, though, to the house, and they took her van without her knowledge again and went out to buy heroin and a syringe. But they were unable to find heroin, so Adam bought a syringe, and he said that they could kill Mrs. Robinson by filling the syringe with bleach and an air bubble and injecting it into her.
Well... maybe.
Yeah.
If they injected bleach into an artery.
Well, how are they going to know where they're hitting?
Well, I know. And this air bubble stuff, this is one of those common misconceptions that if you inject air into a vessel, you're going to cause a fatal embolus.
Right.
You have to inject a ton of air.
Right.
To do anything. So that's not a viable, I shouldn't say viable, not a reasonable way to consider homicide.
Right.
The bleach might work.
Yeah, but isn't she going to wake up if you try and inject her with something?
One would think, right?
Yeah.
You're sound asleep and all of a sudden there's a needle in your arm or someplace.
That's just horrible.
Yeah. Again, I think this is the drug's influence.
Yeah.
They're just not thinking this through.
Right.
So first you got to find a blood vessel. You can't just stick it in a muscle and inject it. That's not going to do anything.
Yes. But I think we're getting a little bit off the point here. The point is not the method or how they tried to do it. The point is, why would they want to do this to her doing it at all is just horrific, and I don't understand how their minds even went there, drugs or no drugs.
Yes.
Well, in the kitchen, Adam put Vicky into a sleeper hold and tried to make her unconscious. So she was asleep. They woke her up. Then she got mad at Valesa and told the kids to go home. And she's walking in through the kitchen, and Adam grabs her and puts her into a headlock, thinking that if he holds her long enough, she'll go unconscious.
Right.
Which is probably another foolish thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So he tries to inject her with the syringe, but after a few minutes, the bleach hadn't killed her. So then he stabbed her with a knife. And shortly thereafter, the three heard moaning from the kitchen, so Adam grabbed the knife and went back in there. And Adam later told John that he stabbed Vicky 2 more times and tried to break her neck. So this is just a huge, horrible nightmare of a mess.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, there's blood all over the place because she's been stabbed repeatedly.
Right.
And they're trying to break, oh, God.
Yeah, well, John had said that Adam did it and that Valesa helped him and held her down.
Yeah, and Valesa said she did it.
Valesa said she did it herself, initially. She changed her story within a couple of months in jail.
Okay. So her story was that Adam did it?
Yes. That she just didn't save her mom, but that she didn't have anything to do with it. So a few hours later, I don't know what they did for these few hours. That's another creepy thing. But a few hours later, they cleaned the kitchen with bleach and towels, and Adam put Vicky's body into this large trash can and loaded the trash can along with shovels and a hoe into Vicky's van, and then they drove off to a wooded area down by John's house where they were planning to bury her. So now it must be near morning.
I would think.
If all these hours have passed.
Yeah, because it was 11 o'clock when the dinner party broke up and people went home, right? Somewhere around there?
Right.
And then they're at the Denny's and they make the plans and they go to try to buy the heroin and find the syringe and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah, it's getting light out.
Yes.
So not surprisingly, the digging was unsuccessful. They ended up concealing the trash can with foliage and planned to come back later. Duh.
Yeah, that's terrible. It's not only stupid, it's horrible to do that to your own mother.
The three later returned to the Robinsons' house and took her credit cards, cash, and ATM card, since Valesa knew her mother's personal identification number.
Right.
So the three spent the next few days in Ybor City, which is part of Tampa, the old Cuban part.
So this is kind of a party area.
Right, big party area. They used Vicky's money to get tattoos and stay at motels. They also purchased 20 bags of concrete, a bucket, and a trash can with the intention of dumping Vicky's body in a canal.
So I don't see any kind of remorse or worry going on here.
No.
It's pretty scary.
So while Adam, Valesa, and John were in Ybor City, Vicky's boyfriend, Jim Englert, reported she was missing. Adam learned from a friend that both he and Valesa were on the news, so the three decided to leave town and flee to Phoenix. I don't know how they picked Phoenix.
I don't know.
So they forgot about burying her.
Well, I don't
or
know.
Or disposing of her body, because they had to get out of town.
That was too much work.
Adam told a story that matched John's, but he added one startling detail. That was Valesa had helped kill her mother. He said Valesa held Vicky's legs down while he stabbed her. Each of the teens drew an identical map of where they had dumped Vicky's body. They had dumped Vicky in a garbage can in the woods surrounded by brush. Now she's in this closed container.
Mm-hmm.
In the Florida heat.
For 5 days?
For several days. So she was very decomposed.
Ugh.
None of the teens cried or showed any signs of remorse.
Nope.
John Wispel pled guilty to second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison for exchange of his testimony against Adam Davis. He admitted to handing off a knife to Adam, which was used in Vicky's murder. He also testified that Valesa held her down and punched her mother as Adam stabbed her. In Adam Davis's trial, his attorneys agreed that he had killed Vicky, but said it was not premeditated.
I don't know how it could not be premeditated.
It sure sounds premeditated, doesn't it?
Yeah.
According to testimony, it was Valesa who had been plotting to kill her mother. But John testified that Adam had done the killing. After just 2 hours of deliberation, Adam was convicted, and he received a sentence of death.
Yes, he did.
So the guy who ratted his friend out got 25 years.
For testifying against them.
Testifying against him. Adam was the actual killer, which his attorneys agreed was the case. He was sentenced to die. Now we still have Valesa. In her trial, Adam Davis and John Wispel were demonized as the true perpetrators. Valesa's defense team dressed her in schoolgirl skirts and cardigan sweaters with her hair in barrettes. Innocent teen.
Right.
They set up large posters of Adam Davis's mugshot. According to the defense, Valesa had been corrupted and victimized by Adam Davis, who killed her mother and kidnapped her across the country, financing the trip with Vicky's credit cards. So she was this sweet, innocent young girl.
Well, so at first she was taking responsibility for it to kind of save him. But then I guess this devotion wore off after she was in jail for a couple months and realized what she was facing.
Yeah.
And so she turned and blamed everything on him and his friend.
Right.
But John Wispel, he testified that the murder had been Valesa's idea. And he also testified about Valesa's behavior during and after the murder of her mother. Because she didn't seem upset that her mother was dead, she told John and Adam that she was happy that her mother was gone, actually. So that's quite something to say.
Mm-hmm. Now, but all her actions prior to the murder would suggest that she'd be happy.
Sure.
Right?
But I think a lot of parents can, I mean, a lot of kids can say they hate their parents, but they're not going to do something like this and have no remorse.
No, so but this kid sounded like she was kind of beyond that.
Yeah, maybe. Well, obviously she was, because this happened.
Yeah.
Now, because she was only 15 years old, she didn't face the death penalty. She faced the possibility of life in prison without parole. Now, Valesa didn't take the stand in her own defense, so that's not surprising.
No, it's not.
Prosecutors told the jury that Valesa planned and helped in her mother's murder so that she could be with Adam Davis. Now, the defense said that Valesa didn't participate in her mother's murder. She didn't try to save her mother, which sounds horrible, but that's not a crime.
Right.
So according to the defense, Valesa had been led astray by this older man, Adam Davis. So in addition to the first-degree murder charge, the jury had the option of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and even manslaughter. So this was a difficult case for the jury to decide, because many people didn't believe that a 15-year-old, especially a girl, was capable of murdering her mother. Now others felt that she needed to be imprisoned for life for her part in the murder. So just a few hours into their deliberations, the jury was deadlocked. Their initial vote had jurors for first degree, second degree, third degree, and manslaughter, so it was all broken up. And the judge ordered a break and sent jurors home for the night, and then the next day, he wanted them to go back to deliberate. And twice during their deliberations, they asked for further instructions and they had questions. But finally, the jury did return with their verdict, and what they came up with was guilty of murder in the third degree. Now, by finding her guilty of third-degree murder, the jury had concluded that Vicki Robinson died during an aggravated battery, absent the intent to kill. So that doesn't really make sense.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It sounds like their intent to kill was there.
Absolutely. And it was there with Adam, but I guess it's right. A separate trial. But the judge thought that this was probably just some kind of compromised verdict that the jurors came up with, because there were jurors on opposite sides, some for first-degree murder and some for manslaughter.
Yeah.
So they kind of compromised.
I guess the jurors all agreed that she should be responsible in some way.
Yes.
And if it wasn't going to be first-degree murder, and it's not going to be manslaughter. I think there are people on equals on both sides of that issue.
Right.
So it's going to be second or third degree.
Right.
And they picked third.
They did. But the outcome, it really outraged a lot of people, because Valesa clearly wasn't an innocent bystander. She was more involved in the murder than John Wispel, who needs to serve a full 25 years. Now, she also showed no remorse and made no efforts to save her mother, and Valesa was sentenced to 15 years for the third-degree murder, and she got an additional 5 years for Grand Theft Auto, for taking the van.
Okay.
So she got 20 years, which I think some people would argue is not nearly enough.
That does seem kind of lenient, but I was looking at some studies.
Okay.
That women perpetrators tend to get lighter sentences than males.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that doesn't really surprise me.
I don't want to sound sexist, but it's because they're female.
I know, but why? Because people don't think they're as evil?
Right.
Huh.
I think. I mean, and they also, though, they made a distinction, because we've seen some particularly horrible crimes. So the callousness or the heinousness of the murder would play a role. So just as an example of one of the more recent cases we did, Jodi Arias was sentenced to die.
Well, she ended up with life in prison.
And ended up with life in prison.
Right.
But
that was super heinous.
That was a horrendous crime.
Yeah.
So if we're going to believe that this kid participated by holding her mother down, she got the lighter sentence.
Well, yeah, probably too light. Although 20 years is a long time.
And this is 20 years without the chance of parole or anything.
Well, she was released in 2013. So she ended up serving...
So she served...
Like 14 years.
Yeah.
Because she got time served for the time she was in jail before her trial. And
mm-hmm.
then she got some time off for good behavior.
Okay. So she's been out.
Yep, she's been out. She went down to live with relatives in Mississippi. Now, Wispel, he will be released in 2020. So he still has a ways to go.
Right.
And Adam Davis, his death sentence has been upheld by the Florida Supreme Court at least twice, so he's still on death row.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's not getting out.
No.
He might not be put to death.
Well, he might, though. Florida's pretty busy doing that, aren't they?
Yeah, not recently.
No, they used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing is that Valesa had a baby in 2015.
Okay.
Yep. So that's... I don't know. I feel kind of mixed feelings about that because I think someone's 15, maybe they should get a second chance. But then it's
yeah,
so brutal.
But it was brutal and she's shown no remorse or made any apology.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
So, but then you look at it, I mean, if she had good behavior, I mean, she got out earlier because of some good behavior on her part.
Right.
So maybe she has... overcome her difficulties.
Maybe. I hope so. It's hard to tell. That's the thing. Kind of hate to let people out because you don't know exactly what they're thinking or what they're going to do once they're out.
Right. But she is out and she's had a child.
Yes. Now, some of her mother's friends have commented on her release and they felt that it was kind of an easy sentence, but they think that Vicky would have wanted her to have another chance.
Well, yes. I mean, if I'm a Christian woman,
yeah,
I would go down that path.
Right.
And figure that there's always a possibility of redemption.
Sure. I guess so.
Yeah. Really.
Okay.
I mean, I think, and maybe I'm sounding too churchy or something, but I think if you're a devout Christian, that's how you would look at things. Maybe more so than Joe Schmo off the street.
Maybe, but it's just such a terrible crime. I don't know.
Well, it is.
It just shows no caring, no feelings, really, at all. It's brutal. I mean, it would be one thing if she didn't help. That's bad enough. But if she actually held her down and punched her.
It sounds like she participated in it.
Sure does, yeah. Okay. Well, I've got lots of feedback today. If we're done with this, we can move ahead and have a little musical interlude and start on feedback.
Okay, let's do the feedback.
Okay.
I'm a bad boy. I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart.
Welcome to Feedback.
So I'm going to go first.
Great.
Ha. So I have Lady London on YouTube regarding Forsaken, which is the episode with Susan Smith who drowned her children.
Yes.
And Lady London says, I saw in a doc that what finally broke her was a police technique they call come to Jesus. They prayed with her to ask Jesus for help, and that broke her, which is what happened.
Yes, I remember that.
Because they weren't getting anywhere.
Took a long time for her to confess.
It took several days, but they finally got it because they appealed to her religious side.
Exactly.
So I found an analysis of her confession that was done by the Laboratory for Scientific Interrogation. And the scan technique, which is scientific content analysis technique, was used to analyze the language used by Susan Smith in her confession. So here's her statement, and then I'll go over some points that the author of this paper prepared.
Okay.
So when I left my home on Tuesday, October 25th, I was very emotionally distraught. I didn't want to live anymore. I felt like things could never get any worse. I was going to ride around a little while and then go to my mom's. As I rode and rode and rode, I felt even more anxiety coming upon me about not wanting to live. I felt I couldn't be a good mom anymore, but I didn't want my children to grow up without a mom. So I felt I had to end our lives to protect us from any grief or harm. I had never felt so lonely and so sad in my entire life. I was in love with someone very much, but he didn't love me and never would. I had a very difficult time accepting that, but I had hurt him very much and I could see why he could never love me. When I was at John D. Long Lake, I had never felt so scared and unsure as I did then. I wanted to end my life so bad, and was in my car ready to go down that ramp into the water. And I did go part way, but I stopped. I went again and stopped. I then got out of the car and stood by the car, a nervous wreck. Why was I feeling this way? Why was everything so bad in my life? I had no answer to these questions. I dropped to the lowest point when I allowed my children to go down to the ramp into the water without me. Took off screaming, oh God, no, what have I done? Why did you let this happen? I wanted to turn around so bad and go back, but I knew it was too late. I was an absolute mental case. I couldn't believe what I had done. I love my children with all my heart in parentheses. That will never change. I have prayed to them for forgiveness and hope they will find it in their heart in parentheses again. To forgive me. I never meant to hurt them. I am sorry for what has happened, and I know that I need some help. I don't think I will ever be able to forgive myself for what I have done. My children, Michael and Alex, are with our Heavenly Father now, and I know that they will never be hurt again. As a mom, that means more than words could ever say. I knew from day one the truth would prevail, but I was so scared I didn't know what to do. It was very tough emotionally to sit and watch my family hurt like they did. It was time to bring a peace of mind to everyone, including myself. My children deserve to have the best, and now they will. I broke down on Thursday, November 3rd, and told Sheriff Howard Wells the truth. It wasn't easy, but after the truth was out, I felt like the world was lifted off my shoulders. I know now that this is going to be a tough and long road ahead of me. At this very moment, I don't feel I will be able to handle what's coming, but I have prayed to God that He give me the strength to survive each day and to face those times and situations in my life that will be extremely painful. I have put my total faith in God, and He will take care of me. So that's her official statement.
Okay.
Now, the analysis of this. The first sentence in a statement is a very important one. It is the point where the subject decided to start the statement.
Okay, so she started it.
So she started when I left my home.
Right.
So his point is, it's interesting to note that many false statements start with left. Hmm. Now, he doesn't go on to explain that.
No, because that I don't understand why, but that's interesting.
Right. So, second point, I wanted it in my life so bad it was in my car, ready to go down that ramp, and then I got out of the car and stood by the car, a nervous wreck. Please note the change in pronouns from my car to the car.
So that's like distancing herself from it?
The use of the car when it should be my car is an indication of possible deception.
Okay.
So the subject said, I dropped to the lowest point when I allowed my children to go down the ramp into the water without me. The emotions are located exactly at the perfect place at the peak of the statement, as dictated by logic. Since the emotions are located by logic, it is a strong indicator of deception. So the subject used the pronoun we or are in only one sentence.
Okay. So what does that mean? She's using the singular pronoun.
Well, she didn't use the pronoun. Except one time, where she said, I felt I had to end our lives.
Right.
So, during the ride around a little while, she didn't use the pronoun we, even though the children were with her in the car.
Right. But does he say what that means?
The only time she used the we, meaning togetherness, is the time she decided to end their lives.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Huh.
Subject said, I didn't want my children to grow up without a mom. I dropped to the lowest point when I allowed my children to go down the ramp. I love my children with all my heart. My children, Michael and Alex, are with our Heavenly Father now. My children deserve to have the best, and now they will. This analysis says, due to the fact that the pace of speech, and definitely the pace of writing, is slower than the pace of thinking, there is a natural tendency to shorten the speech. So this is to say that in general it is expected that people would introduce others into the statement going from the long introduction and continuing to a shorter introduction. So therefore, when someone goes from a short introduction to a longer one, it would indicate a bad relationship.
Hmm. So a bad relationship with their children?
Right.
Huh.
One should note that the longer formal introduction was used in the context of the children being with our Heavenly Father, as in being dead.
Exactly, yeah.
Subject said, I love my children with all my heart, and I prayed for forgiveness and hope they will find it in their heart to forgive me. Please note that in both places the word heart is placed in parentheses, indicating it might have been added by the newspaper in order to make the sentence readable. However, it is quite likely that the subject didn't say it.
Hmm. I don't see what the big difference is, though, if she uses heart or not.
Well, he says, if the subject didn't say that she loves him with all her heart, then we cannot say that she loved him.
Okay, that doesn't really make sense to me, but I'm not a psychologist or whatever, so.
Then the final part, I've never felt so lonely and sad. I never felt so scared and unsure. I never meant to hurt them. Never is not as strong as didn't.
Sure, and I just think it really sticks out to me, all the me and I statements, how she's really focused on herself.
Right, rather than her kids.
Right, yeah. All about her.
So that's when you say never rather than didn't.
Yeah.
They're weak denials.
I could see that. Okay. I could see that. That does make sense to me.
So a lot of that I don't understand as well as I think I should. but I can see the points that are being made.
Right.
And getting back to Lady London's comment.
Right.
I think that's how they got the confession.
Well, yeah, I think, too, by using her religion, they made it more palatable to confess for her, to put it in that kind of a construct.
They did.
It allowed her to distance herself in some ways.
Yeah, although in her statement, there's some deception.
Yes.
And some indication that it was an intentional act rather than a premeditated act,
I mean, I think that's what was determined in court. She was definitely downplaying it as if it was just this spur-of-the-moment thing, but it really wasn't.
Right.
She kind of had that planned out.
Yes, she did.
I don't really believe she was going to go in herself either, because I think going in that slowly, she would have been able to get out anyway.
Yes.
These were little kids in car seats. Couldn't get out.
They wouldn't have been able to get out.
Yeah.
They were pinned in.
Yeah, I guess can't have any sympathy for her. That's really sick.
I don't either.
No. Okay. Well, thanks, Dickie. I have an email from Caitlin in Los Angeles responding to our last episode, Fatal Exposure, the Jodi Arias story. And Caitlin said, your episode on Jodi Arias' murder of Travis Alexander got me thinking about women and violence. As a rule of thumb, men are responsible for over 90% of serious crimes, such as assaults, homicides, and violent robberies. Why is there such a large gender gap, and is it likely to persist? One might imagine that lower violent crime rates for women reflect a generally lower level of aggression, yet marriage researchers observe the opposite pattern. Women are more likely to pick fights with their husbands, they are quicker to escalate verbal aggression, and they are as likely to use physical aggression as men. So despite these counterintuitive findings, men are much more likely to be convicted of domestic violence. But the obvious reason for that is that men are generally larger and stronger, and they might have more experience with physical aggression, like being in contact sports, things like that. Now, another intriguing difference between men and women is in the context of domestic disputes, is that men generally become more physiologically aroused in terms of increased blood pressure. And if the body's revved up for action, damaging aggression is more likely. Moreover, when it occurs, the aggression is more likely to be extreme, uncontrolled, or disinhibited, words that are sometimes used to explain the violence, usually in grisly crimes of violence. Now, in the vast majority of such crimes, the perpetrators are men. Although men are much more likely to perpetrate violent crimes, societies with an excess of women in the population have higher crime rates, because there's more extramarital sexuality and greater male-male competition over sex partners. So modern women are behaving much more like men when it comes to risk-taking and aggression. One sign of this phenomenon is greater participation in contact sports and dangerous competitions such as horse racing or car racing. According to anthropologists, in societies where women compete more amongst each other, whether in occupations, over spouses, or whatever it is, their levels of stress hormones and testosterone increase. As women have begun to take leadership positions in large corporations, they've also acted as leaders in criminal enterprises. One of the most successful Latin American drug kingpins was a Colombian woman, Griselda Bianco, known as La Madrina, who ran an extensive U.S. operation from Miami. She's not the only woman to rise to the top in organized crime. That there are female equivalents of Pablo Escobar is intriguing from the perspective of gender differences in violence. Yet, there have always been female sociopaths, just fewer of them than males. Such figures certainly challenge gender stereotypes. Yet most evolutionary psychologists would predict that even amongst the restricted population of violent criminals, females will continue to be less extremely violent. The reason is that women remain generally less violent and more risk-averse than men, and the risk aversion is tied to an evolutionary past in which women did most of the child care and avoided violence as a way of staying alive to protect their children. Now, that theory has already failed in respect to vanishing gender differences in traffic accidents. So we should not be too shocked if more women also take up bank robbery and other violent crimes as their job. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well written.
Yeah.
But I think that's going back to one of our recurring themes of nature versus nurture.
Yes, because you've got the evolutionary, and then you've got what's going on in the world today.
Right.
But it seems like Caitlin believes that men will still be more violent despite changes in society.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. So it might be a higher evolutionary component.
Yes, could be.
And there's also the way that boys are raised versus the way that girls are raised.
Well, and that's changed, or is changing.
Yeah.
But still, there's a difference.
There is. And it's changed in some ways, but there's still a lot of, you know, there's a big thing with girls being princesses. That's kind of bigger than ever, it seems like.
Yeah. Now, you just had sisters, so.
Yeah.
And my household, we had me and my sister.
Right.
And I know that my parents raised my sister differently than they raised me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
In what ways?
Well, like you said, she was the girl.
Yeah.
She was the princess.
Okay.
And I was the boy that did boy things, played with army soldiers and did games in the woods, you know.
Yeah, I think we might have made some progress with toys being a little more gender neutral.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, when you go to Toys R Us, they still have the girls section pretty much and the boys section.
They do. And even where they're intermixed, you can clearly see which ones are geared towards girls and which ones are geared towards boys.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. Although I was a tomboy, so I always had the boy toys anyway.
Uh-huh.
So I was breaking the rules.
Way back then.
Yeah.
Well, not way back.
Wasn't that long ago.
No.
Okay, so you have another one? Another letter?
I do. I have an email from Dave in Chicago about Ted Bundy. So Dave says, it makes perfect sense to me that Ted Bundy worked to create a good guy image. He got his college degree in psychology from the University of Washington. He volunteered at the suicide prevention hotline as part of those studies. Separately, he was on a crime prevention task force for the state of Washington as part of his ill-fated political career. While Bundy was a true sociopath, some have speculated that he pursued these particular paths in order to help him commit his crimes without getting caught. I don't think there's any question about that.
No, I think that's probably true.
Bundy learned what vulnerable people would respond positively to when working at the suicide hotline, and he saw how law enforcement worked and how they tracked down criminals as part of his task force job. So, in a sense, he was doing homework.
Yes.
And learning how to avoid detection.
Right.
So, I think we discussed how intelligent Bundy was.
Right.
When we did the case. And I can see where he would be a keen observer of things going on around him and learn how to blend into the background and be less conspicuous.
Right. Well, and another part of that is with Ann Rule, when she worked with him at the suicide hotline, she said that he was very good with people and actually helped her save some lives.
Right.
So that makes you realize that his powers could have been used for good instead of bad, but they were used for bad.
Yes, he took the dark path.
Exactly. That's right. But I definitely think that's why he got into that. I think that's why he had the interest in the law, because he broke the law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he did these things with the intention of gaining knowledge to help him commit the crimes that he committed.
And get away with it.
Right.
Yeah. Which he did for quite a while, unfortunately.
He did.
Yeah. Okay, I have one more. It's an email from Julie from Indiana, and she's also responding to the fatal exposure, the Jodi Arias story, but this is a shorter one. So, Julie says, an abused man will sometimes pick partners who remind him of his abusive parent or caretaker. The drama, criticism, and emotional intensity of the relationship are at his comfort level because they are so familiar. Although Travis was smart enough to see the kind of woman he did want, in parentheses it says Deanna, Mimi, etc., Jodi may have been the one he was most comfortable with, sadly. So I thought that was a very insightful email.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but yeah. I mean, this is how he was raised. His mother did all sorts of abusive things towards him.
Well, we've heard a lot about how he was attracted to her for the sex, but maybe he was attracted to her because she was like his mother.
Well, put it another way.
Okay.
She acted the same way that his mother acted.
Well, or I don't know if it was the same way.
In a similar way.
Well, maybe.
And he was comfortable with that.
She was abusive in ways, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's pretty sad, though.
Yes, it is.
Kind of, you know, because you like to think that we can fight against these things and make our own decisions in life. But sadly, I think a lot of this stuff we're just stuck with, and it's hard to change.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's a good point that the letter writer makes.
Yeah.
And it was not good for Travis.
No, not at all. Terrible. Okay, so that's all I have for feedback.
That's all I got.
Okay, I'd just like to give a little reminder before we go about our team Tie Grabber. You can join Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com for as little as $2 a month. And when you're a member of Team Tie Grabber, you get access to members-only podcasts, which we have a few out. We started in March. We're just waiting now for the trial of Michael McCarthy in Boston for the murder of baby Bella Bond. We're waiting for that to wrap up. I've been following that trial. And we're going to do that for our next members only episode. So I think that when this podcast comes out, the case will probably be going to the jury around that time. So maybe a few days after this podcast comes out, we'll have that out.
We would hope to.
Pretty soon, yeah. Okay. Also, please follow us on Instagram and on Twitter at TieGrabberPods. And keep the feedback coming. I really enjoy the feedback.
We love the feedback.
That's right.
Makes us think.
And if you haven't done it yet and you're kind enough to do so, we would love a 5-star review on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.
See you at the quiet end.
Bye-bye.